Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of The Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you? How are things? How is sunny Gauteng today? Is it sunny?
It's not sunny. We've been having a bit of weird Capetonian weather where it's been both relatively chilly and relatively wet. Not sunny Gauteng at the moment. Which differs, I hear, from you guys down south, because you've been having something of a heat wave.
We have just emerged from the maw of hell, which thankfully seems to now be over. But those were, shall we say, rather unpleasant days, according to my weather app, which has been known to fudge things. On Wednesday, the town of Paternoster in the Western Cape. By Saldanha Bay, was 51 degrees. I don't know if that's true, but if so, it would have made it the hottest place on the planet at that particular time, and I'm sure broke every single record. Absolutely crazy. Anyway.
And that's hot, especially given that the hottest place on Earth is impressive, especially given the Strait of Hormuz is on fire. So, that's...
Yeah, the causes there are slightly different. but anyway. Speaking of the United States and all that, this week we had another little dust up between South Africa and the United States. While speaking at a conference, the new US ambassador to South Africa, Brett Bozell, said he was talking about the relationship between America and South Africa. And he said that he doesn't care whether the South African courts rule that the chant kill the Boer is not hate speech. He believed that it was hate speech. This drew a furious reaction from the ANC and some of its ideological bedfellows. The EFF demanded he be expelled from the country. Fikile Mbalula had some rather bellicose words about how he must watch himself or else they'd send him packing. There was much upset from government, saying that he had undermined the decision and integrity of our courts by refusing to accept their ruling on this matter. Well, the ambassador then went on X to say, I want to clarify that while my personal view, like that of many South Africans, is that the Kill the Boer chant constitutes hate speech, the U.S. government respects the independence and findings of South Africa's judiciary. So not quite a sort of backtracking, but sort of a clarification that this was not the official U.S. stance, per se. The day after that, the Department of International Relations and Cooperation seemed to try and smooth over things and declare a kind of victory by saying that it had summoned Mr. Bozell, where he had apologized and expressed regret over the remarks that were viewed as undiplomatic following a meeting with government officials. The Director General for DIRCO said that officials met with him to discuss the comment that he had expressed regret that his remarks created the impression he was not committed to working constructively with the South African government. He apologized and expressed regret, including for comments that appeared to undermine the judiciary. And then there was some sort of stuff about how the ambassador understands the need for redress policies or something like that. So this issue, I think, seems pretty much over now as we reach the end of the week, and I'm sure no one will remember it a week or two from now. But Herman, I think this just speaks to a very strong theme we've seen from government. One really sort of gets the impression, looking at this whole episode, that the ANC was just waiting in the wings with something to jump on the new US ambassador so that they could feel like they were, I don't know, maybe getting one back for what had happened to their ambassadors who had been sent to the US. And this seemed very much like a big storm in a teacup to me, in the sense that it was a sort of manufactured issue by the government. What's your take on the story?
I think manufactured is exactly the right word. It all just feels so petty and performative. And it simply isn't convincing. The idea that the court, that judiciary had been undermined by what Bozell said is, I think, farcical. But you can just see the sort of Pretoria bubble of, you know, these play actors who genuinely think that international practices and relations respond in any real substantive way to what they say or think or feel. The idea that the remark made by any ambassador could undermine the South African judiciary is I think just pathetic. The courts don't get their authority from American ambassadors; they get it from the Constitution. And I'm sort of glad that Bozell didn't retract the remark but qualified it, because I think his second remark on X is right. Most South Africans are not the constitutional court, nor are they the ANC or the EFF. To the extent that they care about this, which I doubt the majority do, but to the extent that they do, the data shows that South Africans in general are not, you know, rearing to sing "Kill the Boer, Kill the Farmer." And since 2010, when this whole thing started, it has been one frustratingly long theater that reminds me so much of the model UN and moot court at university, where you have to very fiercely pretend that what you have been told to feel strongly about actually matters in the greater scheme of things. And quite frankly, it really doesn't. That said, I do think Bozell was incautious in his phrasing. As an objective commentator or even a subjective commentator, you can say, I don't care what the courts say, blah. Like, I am willing to say, I don't care what the South African Constitutional Court says on this. I think it's hate speech. I think it is a perverse and a political judgment and a legal nonsense. But I'm not a plenipotentiary sort of ambassador emissary to another country sent to represent my nation at the pleasure of the host nation. It is a different story. Saying something before a senatorial committee and saying something in South Africa after having been granted the diplomatic privilege of being in South Africa to represent the US. I think Bozell could have been more cautious in his phrasing, but I think his fundamental point stands. Most South Africans, I think, would agree with him to the extent that they have an opinion on this matter. And it, I saw something from a report a few hours ago where someone said, as South Africa's diplomatic structures and posture around the world collapses, they pick petty battles with the USA. And I think that's pretty much what happened here.
Yeah.
We had US ambassador for a year after the previous two that we tried to send there were simply not taken seriously, lightweights, or frankly, embarrassments. At the same time, our DERCO network of embassies across the world are in a shameful state. The buildings are collapsing. The patronage networks are in full flow. And South African citizens overseas have absolutely no real government support. And instead of focusing on that,
recently in the Middle East, where DERCO, shall we say, did not cover itself in glory by warning South Africans ahead of time of what might be going down.
No. And amidst this, that's where I think the performativeness comes in, is that this is the one that's going to grab headlines, that's going to virtue signal, that's going to make Ronald Lamola feel like he's a big beast. It just doesn't matter. South Africa isn't that important in the global scheme of things. And I saw a New Zealand newspaper article the other day where the guy wrote, it's time for New Zealand to just accept, and it seems that the government in New Zealand is accepting that what it thinks about global affairs doesn't really influence global affairs. And I think if a country like New Zealand, with a significantly greater, I think, global presence and footprint and economic credibility, can come to that realization, it just makes this routine that we've got here so pathetic. It's cosplaying at diplomacy. And what's worse is, I think Bozell's start as an ambassador has been genuinely solid. We spoke about this, I think, last week, visiting the Apartheid Museum, visiting District 6, making remarks that, frankly, should be seen in the context of the Trump administration as bordering on friendship. And yet and this the South is, this African is, this authorities
what really gets my goat. This is what really gets my goat on this particular issue, is that it would be very easy, I think, and suit the domestic politics for the Trump administration to really turn us into kind of a boogeyman to satisfy a particular slice of the kind of MAGA base there. And, you know, really rail against us, send us an ambassador who was combative and would make good, you know, essentially good TV, good social media content.
Yeah,
and
the Pam,
you know, just use us as... Exactly, right? Just really kind of get into a sort of nasty fight with us, hit us with more tariffs on this, or close off exports of this, or remove some sort of program, whatever. And yet that's not who the Americans sent. They sent someone who has shown that he is serious about this relationship and is genuinely trying to make South Africa and the U.S. Have a better relationship, be on better terms. And the first thing we do is kind of find an excuse to get into a fight with him and attack him and pull him out and really stretch credibility in doing that. And so, I don't know, you know, maybe this track continues, the relationship gets worse, government finds an excuse to remove him, and then the next ambassador, if there is one sent, might not be so diplomatic. And once again, the question is, how does this actually serve South Africans?
And part of the frustration here is we have so much to gain from American buy-in into our economy. The South African economy being fundamentally brittle is, and we've seen this especially since the GNU's establishment, is such a sentiment-heavy thing. The markets, our bonds, and these things are so vulnerable to what the world thinks is going on here. I mean, the economic picture and consequences of American buy-in in the South African project, in the Ramaphosa project, if we're going to talk that language of the ANC, in the GNU project, would be massive. The moment America indicates to world markets that they think South Africa is worth taking a second look at, they think South Africa is inching in the right direction, the level of market sentiment positivity that could be unlocked just by that is immense, because we're working from such a low base. So instead of appreciating that this is a relationship that can actually have fundamental socioeconomic consequences, it can unlock investment, it can unlock capital for economic momentum. No, that's all thrown by the wayside. Ibrahim Rasool was embarrassed, so let's get one over on the Americans. And as Bozell said, they're not looking for a pro-US South Africa. They'd be happy with non-alignment. So the approach from the Americans, which could have been, as you say, heavily antagonistic, and it isn't. And instead of us going, you know, we have a lot to gain from a positive relationship here, we start playing this petty performative nonsense.
Yeah. You know, and of course, it's amusing because non-alignment is our official position, yes, at least on paper. But in practice, it's not even close to the reality. So they're literally saying, why don't you enforce your own official policy?
Yeah, and the idea that what anything he said was controversial, I mean, I saw people drag in his comments about BEE and how that's a barrier to investment. I mean, what the truth is the truth. These aren't radical positions. These aren't Trumpist talking points. And what I think people miss in both the general population, but also in Durko and in the ANC, is that this isn't a Trump problem. It's not that South Africa just needs to survive to 2028 and things will go back to normal. Reuben Brigidy, the guy who flagged the Lady R incident, was a Biden appointee. He was a Democrat. And that was really the start of a turn from Foggy Bottom, negative in active opposition to what the South African government was doing. It started under a Democratic administration. We have lost so much diplomatic goodwill in Washington because we've misread successive administrations, and we've allowed relationships that we had on Capitol Hill with especially senators just to deteriorate. So at the end of the day, people think, Bozell might just be a Trumpist. He's just Trumpy. Look at him going off to kill the Boer. If you think that's the problem here, that Bozell went, is sort of a temporary issue, like the Trump presidency is a temporary issue, and, you know, just get through this by any ugly means necessary and fight in the mud and make yourself feel good. It's just a reality show. In 5 years' time, we'll be back to being serious. Misses so much of what has gone wrong in the South African relationship with the US.
Yeah. Very frustrating to see. And, you know, I don't think it's going to happen, but it would be nice to see the other parties in the GNU pry the ANC's grip off of foreign policy somewhat, because right now it's just sort of, you know, being driven. This is a party with what, less than about 40% of the vote, that is running a completely unilateral foreign policy that doesn't represent the country.
And that's one of the reasons 2029 is really going to be about senior partner status. If another party, most likely the DA, if the senior partner changes, it'll be massive. If just anyone other than the ANC manages Durko, because as I say, we're a sentiment sensitive economy, and just that international change of posture could have significant effects, and not in the airy-fairy diplomatic sense. No, in the real sense of people giving South Africa another chance to possibly be an investment destination.
All right, let's move on to internal ANC shenanigans. Sort of somewhat confusingly, this Patrice Motsepe 27 campaign emerged relatively recently with a website launch calling on Patrice Motsepe to take up leadership of the ANC and essentially throwing his hat in the ring for the leadership. Now, it seems to have since emerged that this campaign was not being run by him, was not being run on behalf of him. Now, maybe he's not telling the truth, but that seems to be all the evidence we have so far, is that he wasn't to do with this, had anything to do with this. And in fact, he was asked after this campaign launched whether he was going to be running for leadership of the ANC. And he said, no, actually, completely no, definitely not doing it. I'm not interested in being in political office. Well, apparently, this hasn't slowed down the Patrice Motsepe for ANC president campaign, which, according to some sources who spoke to the media, they are planning to continue lobbying in secret and have 100,000 T-shirts boosting his campaign in storage already, ready to go. The ANC Secretary General Fikile Mbalula has come out and instructed this group to desist from discussing succession before campaigning is officially opened by the ANC. The group's spokesperson said they fully agree with Patrice Motsepe's sentiments and that this was helpful because it would help them to focus on campaigning for the ANC in the next local government elections. However, anonymous sources in that same group are also saying that they're going sort of full steam ahead. One member who spoke to the media said, if you remember, even when Cyril Ramaphosa was approached, he was asked about 11 times before he admitted it. Admitting you're seeking a leadership position is usually frowned on in the ANC. The campaign is basically looks like it's going to, at least in some form, continue to go along, maybe less high profile. Herman, this is all very strange. I think that Potchefstroom Mosepe probably wouldn't win a leadership contest inside the ANC. But from polling you and I have seen, mostly from the Common Sense Social Research Foundation, shows that he would by far be the best candidate the ANC could pick in terms of popularity. What do you make of this whole mess? It's kind of odd, isn't it?
It is very odd. And for people to understand why the ANC does leadership elections in such an odd way, it's useful to remember the ideology of collectivism that permeates the ANC for the last 50 years, at least. The reason, you know, running for an elected position within the party is frowned on is because the party, the collective, is greater than the individual. It must be, and it shall be, and it will always be. So to run for a leadership election or a leadership position through an active campaign is an affront to collectivism, because you are being presumptuous, you individual, to dare think you could do something for the collective, when in reality, according to this worldview, the collective is all and can, as a collective, call on you to serve or deploy you, or, you know, so it really comes from this mythology of collectivism. It comes from the worldview of a 20th century organization stuck in the 21st century, that, you know, it's not done. It's you're getting above yourself. And in this instance, what I do find funny is the conservative streak that comes out in the ANC of this obedience idea, that obey the greater good. And that's, when I say conservatism, I mean that sort of traditional Toryism. That's where the idea of liberal and conservative came from, is obeyance to the collective or empowerment of the individual. That tension, 150 years ago. So that people should just understand that's why this is sort of frowned upon. But at the same time, the last time anyone took this seriously was in 2012, when Jacob Zuma ran for re-election at the height of his unpopularity. Well, not at the height, but building into that period of 2012 to 2016, really, when the ANC started taking shots for his personal loss of standing. And for months, at least for sort of a year and a half, people were begging Kgalema Motlanthe to challenge Zuma for the leadership of the ANC. And he, being a party man, stuck to this idea that you don't campaign for the leadership, you get campaigned for, you get asked by the collective, which meant that he only launched his campaign, or accepted the nomination and therefore ran his campaign, weeks before the vote, and got clobbered with Zuma getting 75% of the vote and he, you know, plodding home with 25% of the vote. Contrast that to the very intense shadow campaign in 2017 with Nkosi Sono Dlamini Zuma against Cyril Ramaphosa. I mean, that's where the whole CR17 comes from. Probably the start of the mobilization in terms of structures that led to MK's establishment. So that was very much shadow campaign. And then you look at Ramaphosa's re-election, where Zweli Mkhize a dark horse candidate, disgraced as a cabinet minister for his role in the Digital Vibe scandal, then comes along in 2022 and gets 43% of the vote, which just shows, number one, Ramaphosa's terrible vulnerability. I mean, if even Zuma could manage to get three quarters of the vote against Halema Motlanthe, and Ramaphosa can't push a competitor like a dark horse competitor like Zweli Mkhize below 40%, you know, the man is politically quite incompetent and weak. But what these indications from 2017 onwards show is that the idea that there could be this restraint, that there won't be negotiations, that there won't be maneuvers, that there won't be a shadow campaign, is utterly, utterly naive. And one can almost understand why Fikile Mbalula wants to enforce that traditional standard that has been out of vogue for at least a decade, because he himself is rumored to be interested in the job. And it is very, very convenient to him if someone like Patrice Motsepe loses standing for daring to express interest in it. On the more practical side of things, can Motsepe win? I frankly don't think so. He doesn't have the grassroots to influence at a mass scale the right delegates being chosen. Nor does he have, I think, the presence and the venality in the party to be able to influence the election at the time, because we all know it is a lucrative business to buy votes at an ANC five-yearly Congress. So, no, it's a mess. But what is even a greater mess is that the ANC has three candidates in the running. Paul Mashatile, who is the most disliked politician in the country, I think, by net favorability standards. Fikile Mbalula, who isn't taken seriously by many people beyond, I think, himself. And someone who also owns the issue of the GNU for the ANC, and it's not quite clear that the ANC is happy or unhappy. We'll see that between now and 2027. So we've got Mashatile, an unliked, disliked thug. We've got Mbalula, a dismissed comical figure at best. And we've got Motsepe, the most credible guy, with, I think, a very small chance of winning. This is a party in crisis. Yeah. And it's historical to see.
It is indeed. Let's move on to our last story, which is just kind of a reminder of, you know, why all these things matter. And I think it illustrates the underlying reality of, you know, why things seem to be in a sort of crisis. So residents of Bugwane village, which is near Malumele in Limpopo, so this is sort of the northeast of Limpopo, very rural area, part of the ANC gets, you know, kind of North Korea levels of support. It's probably the last real stronghold of the party, in the sense that it's kind of completely untouched here. People in this village say they were promised a borehole before the 2024 elections to make sure that they went out to vote, but the promise was not kept. Water supplies are not great to the area because of, and, you know, I'd heard of this before, but this is the first news story I've seen talking about it directly. Illegal connections to the water grid that had damaged the water infrastructure in the area, preventing essentially water flowing. These illegal connections had cut off essentially water supply to about seven villages, including Bugwane. So some journalists from Ground Up went and visited the residents and found that nowadays they either have to buy money from private sellers, which, you know, you have old people on pensions spending sometimes a significant proportion of their pension money on buying water, or they have to collect water from some naturally occurring springs, which, shall we say, are not super sanitary. the villagers have planted thorn bushes around them to try and keep goats and cows away, who, you know, would dirty the water. But it's quite a hectic walk, and obviously you have to carry the water, and the old people can't do that because they're too weak. Seven older people said that they spent all their SASA grant money on this. They spent 250 rand to refill their water tanks from private water sellers. The district municipality, this is part of the Vembe district municipality, spokesperson said, well, you know, water is delivered to this community once or twice a week to 350 to 400 households, and that this is costing the government somewhere between 200,000 and 250,000 rand. However, residents in the village say that the last time any municipal water tank has arrived was in October last year. Herman, this story is just kind of sort of depressing. There's this kind of intense sense of betrayal among people here. Unfortunately, I don't think that there's a great upswelling of support for some opposition that is going to now take over this municipality and change the way things are done. But, you know, when you want an example of why so many ANC supporters, even if they're not ready to, shall we say, vote for someone else, they're not going to show up and vote. I think it's a story like this. What's your take on the story?
It is utterly depressing. And what it brings back to me is this shortcoming of political messaging from non-ANC parties. I remember in 2023 when I, for my sins, worked for the DA for a few months as the head of communications in Gauteng for the party. One thing that struck me about the reality of our politics is that we have places like Midvale and Cape Town where DA government is a reality. Then we have places like Tshwane and Joburg and Ekurhuleni where DA government could be a reality. Then you have places where within a generation or so, you can see the political wind shift towards, you know, a non-ANC government. But then you have places like Vembe, not that it's in Gauteng, but you have places like Merafong and so on, and Vembe, where if you are the DA or a different party, and your voters or potential voters, your constituents, come to you and say, you know, the ANC has failed, what are you telling us? What most parties, those who bother with responding, say, and I remember speaking to DA councillors saying, you know, we tell them things will be better under a DA government. And then you just think that that is kindly described as insufficient. You don't get to hold voters hostage on their own votes and say, vote for us, and until you do so, you will suffer. I get the instinct to do that. I get the establishment political screw you mentality, you didn't vote for us. But if we're going to get serious about how the human mind makes decisions about political loyalties, you have to be better than that. You have to essentially, in sort of summing it up, you have to say, you have to be able to offer free samples of your values, especially to a place like Vembe, where democratic politics is yet to be taken seriously, where you can't just say to people like these families, oh, it'll be better if you vote DA. These people aren't sure where their next meal, where their next clean water will come from. It is an utter it's utter madness to think that a political promise of better governance can upend the Maslow hierarchy of needs and somehow cut through to become a convincing message. So what we're looking at here is a failure, not just of the ANC, but of opposition politics. And I understand that opposition politics can't be everywhere where the ANC failures are. There are simply too many. And I understand that, you know, you can win from certain places or you can bring change and it could flow out to places like Vembe. But it just strikes me as so fundamentally depressing that we are in a situation where suffering under a particular party hasn't given rise to any sort of political change in those spaces. I don't think that's the case nationally, but it certainly is the case there. And it goes back to why we do what we do, why we try to preach to the converted, why we try to get people to appreciate that there are things that can be done. And what the last thing, and with it, I'll sort of wrap up this rambling sermon, is we are seeing the redundancies fail. It's not that the water pipes aren't functional. It's almost a given. They've given up on that. They're now looking at the redundancy water tankers, and that's not even functioning. So if you want to understand why AfriForum and Gift of the Givers manage to earn social capital, it is because they allow social capital of trust earning through solutions to precede any attempt to earn political capital. And we're not seeing that happening. So opposition parties, if they want to break through in areas like this, politics isn't going to be the thing. You're going to have to be an AfriForum, a Gift of the Givers, and show where your compassion is, where your values are. Otherwise, you know, write off these places and be honest about it, because currently we don't have politics extending to the reality of the suffering, and you see these communities giving up.
No, an unpleasant state of affairs indeed. And also, of course, you know, as you point out, just a sort of multi-scale, multi-level failure of governance in this condition. Hopefully with some attention to the story, these specific people might get some help, or government might be embarrassed into doing something. Apparently, the municipal spokesperson did say, well, you know, maybe there'll be enough money in the budget for a borehole next year. So,
maybe something. And on that point, maybe there might be enough money. The mayor earns $1 million a year. That's the standard for mayor of the Vembe district size. So maybe there'll be enough money once we've paid the fat cat salaries.
Just awful stuff. Anyway, sorry to leave you all with such a depressing note before we head into the weekend, but we are at least heading towards the weekend, so that's good. I hope you found the show interesting. Herman, you say apologies for the rambling sermon. I must admit that I think if you listen to the podcast to this level, if you're a regular listener of the podcast and you've listened to this minute, probably not that you're completely adverse to rambling sermons. There's quite a few of them in this question, but anyway. All right, everyone. Have a wonderful weekend. We shall see you all next week on the Daily French Show. Cheers, everyone. Bye-bye.